Good morning to all of you. Welcome to our meeting on this Lord's Day. Please have your Bible open if you have it with you, or your phone on, as the case may be, to Luke chapter 6. Surely a people who believe in the Lord must also believe Him. Those two things don't always go together in our minds, but it would be certainly healthier for us if they did. There is a quickness to say, yes, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And there's an eagerness to say that. But then sometimes there's hesitation to take in what He actually says about how we go about living our lives and being who He has made us and purchased us to be. Last week we gave some thought to what faith looks like. And we used the passages in Luke that occur in between the beginning of the Lord's ministry in Galilee and His choosing 12 men and naming them to be apostles, and we tried to illustrate how faith looks against that background. Today we'd like to look at the other part of the story. This is how following Jesus looks, and we'd like to use the passage right after He chose the 12 men and named them as apostles as a case study in this. This passage is a profoundly important passage. It's normally referred to as the Sermon on the Plain, meaning that Jesus has come down from the mountain where He prayed to God and chose the 12, and now He has with Him down on the level ground where he's with the people and involved with the people. He has in front of Him a group consisting of three different parts. There are the 12, the them that He mentions in verse 17, that Luke mentions in verse 17. Then there's a great crowd of His disciples, people who are wanting to learn how to live from Him and who are wanting to follow Him, who are interested and devoted in that way. And then there's also many more people, a multitude of people who've come from all over, north, south, east, and west, in order to hear Him and to be helped by Him. This passage has a way more material in it than we can do justice to a detail at a time. It needs to be studied in a series, really. And yet it's important to look at it as a whole, because what Jesus teaches has a way of where here's a great truth, and then you look down farther, and then this next one sort of defines that a bit, and then this truth here is important, but this next one helps us to understand it in its proper context and setting. So what I'd like to do with you this morning is to read the passage and make observations that go along that help us see believing in Him means believing Him, and following Him means going in the direction He's going, and walking in His ways means paying attention to what He says His ways are. We've sung about that. We've committed ourselves to allegiance to Him. Let's think about what He says about the direction that He goes, the direction He's headed. First, following Jesus looks like people who understand how to live in the same way He does. A people who have a grasp of reality which matches what Jesus says the reality actually is. This first section, verses 20 through 26, consists of a series of blessings or beatitudes and woes. The blessed part of this means this is the person who really turns out to have the good in life. This is the person who really turns out to be highly favored. This is the person, these are the people who really turn out to have made a success out of living. On the other hand, woe, W-O-E, does not mean I'm pronouncing judgment on you. It doesn't mean here is a threat. It means I feel sorry for you. You have my compassion. This is a pitiful condition you're in. Notice that these two tables of blessings and woe are sort of symmetrical. One of them is reflected in a direct opposite by the other one. And notice that they are not what people normally think about. This is not reality as we think of it. It's what Jesus says, as we commonly think of it. He lifted up his eyes on his disciples and said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you shall be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you, and when they exclude you, and revile you, and spurn your name as evil on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven, for so their fathers did to the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you shall be hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Woe to you when all people speak well of you, for so their fathers did to the false prophets." All right, you believe in him. Do you believe him? Is that how the really blessed and the really to be pitied look to you through modern American Western eyes? There's some things about this reading that might be helpful to be aware of. Notice first off that Jesus is not attaching conditions to any of these statements here. He doesn't mean these to be observations about one possible reality, and he's not saying this is how to be really happy and this is how to end up being judged. He's not inviting us into God's reality. What he's doing is saying, this is reality. He's making a proclamation. This is how he says life really is. Then notice a couple of key words in this. Notice the contrast between the yours is in verse 20, and then verse 24, the you have received. Notice that he mentions the reward that comes with these things at the end of verse 23, a reward that's later on. And notice how there is a contrast throughout this between now, what is now, and what shall be. That lets us in on the idea that Jesus sees reality in view of ultimate things. He sees past the moment and past the generation and past the individual experience to how things turn out in the long run. Seeing things in ultimate reality lets us see how he defines some of what he means throughout the Gospel of Luke. For example, the rich, the hungry, the poor, those who weep, and so on. Remember a couple of stories later on in Luke. In chapter 12, there's the story of the farmer who was tremendously blessed. His crops produced more than could be imagined. He had more than his barns could hold. He decided to build bigger barns and put everything in them. And then he said, remember what he said to himself? So you got self, you got much goods laid up for many years. Just sort of eat, drink, and be merry now. What happened to him? His soul was required that night. He wasn't rich toward God. That might help us to see what Jesus is talking about here. The situations in life where all we're hungry for is what there is in this world. All we possess is in terms of physical riches. All that really hurts us is our own personal pleasure or lack of personal pleasure at the moment. That's the kind of thing Jesus is saying to us. In Luke 16, there's the story of the rich man and Lazarus, you remember? They both die. One, the poor guy, ends up at the table with Abraham, and right next to Abraham at the banquet of the kingdom. And the rich guy ends up in torment, you remember? Not because he's rich, but because that's all that has mattered to him as his life has gone along. And that is how the reverse of fortunes, I guess you could say, that Jesus is talking about in this passage here too. Do you see? If you've said Jesus is Lord, have you agreed with Him on actual reality? It looks so different from common, ordinarily placed power and achievement and recognition and what we always see advertised. And yet Jesus is saying that's how things are going to turn out. That's how things are deep down in people's lives. Then in the second place, look at number 2 here. This is verses 27 through 36. Following Jesus involves doing good, not because of what other people do or how other people have treated you, but doing good to other people because of who you are, and then letting who you are be determined by who God is. In this next section, it looks like a long string of various sayings until you get to looking and you notice that in verse 27 and then again in verse 35 it says love your enemies. And in verse 27 and verse 25 it says do good. In verse 31 it says as you wish that others would do to you, do so to them. What's that called? It's the golden rule, isn't it? That's the standard of the teaching of Jesus here. And at verse 36, it said, be merciful even as your Father is merciful. It's asking us to not be reactionary, but to be people who know who we are because God is our Father, and then to choose to respond, or to choose to act toward other people in that way. If you believe in Jesus, then believe Him about this way of living. It's different from the world right now. Verse 27, but I say to you who hear, love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. To one who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from one who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either, your outer coat and your shirt. Give to everyone who begs from you, and from the one who takes your goods, do not demand them back. As you wish that others would do to you, do so to them. Don't let your enemy define who you are. Don't let the people who in the world who mistreat God's people determine your mood, your course of conduct, and the way you go about your life. If you're headed the Lord's way, follow the one who, even as he was being crucified, said, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. That is a high, high standard, impossible beyond measure in many ways, and yet that's the direction he's headed. You notice in this reading that Jesus uses several illustrations of how God's people might be victimized in the world. But he insists that we have the dignity, that we maintain the dignity to decide how we're going to act, that we're not victims. If they hate you, do good to them. If they curse you, bless them. If they abuse you, pray for them. If they strike you on the other cheek, then show that you're stronger than that. Do not let them conquer in that way. If they take one part of your garment, give them the other one. If they assault your compassion by begging, then don't withhold loving action from them. Now notice the defining statement in verse 31 is the golden rule there. Do as you'd have them do unto you, knowing what you know and being who you are. Do what you would have them do to you. You can't escape the responsibility of thought and deciding what the loving thing is. But also there's determination to do the loving thing. On the other hand, don't let your friends define what your behavior is going to be either. You're still a child of God, so even with your friends, don't make it a let's trade off. You do this, and then I'll do that for you. You go first, and then I'll match it. Instead, what he says is, if you love those, this is verse 32, if you love those who love you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. People who never heard anything about God love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those who from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to get back the same amount. That's a crucial statement. If you're just operating on the what's in it for me principle, how do I get back what I wanted, then you're living as if you're somebody who never heard about Jesus Christ, much less somebody who believes him or believes in him. But, verse 35, love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you'll be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. Notice how this passage has defined the first one. In verse 23, he talked about being your reward being great in heaven, if you've been excluded and reviled and so forth on account of the Son of Man. But here, he is saying, this involves you're still treating people like the Son of Man did. If Jesus had only ever been kind to people who gave him completely the place that he deserved, if Jesus had only done good for the people who showed him completely the goodness of which he was worthy, if he only blessed those who bless him completely like he deserved to be, there would have been a mighty small group who'd been recipients of his kindness. He went beyond that. It was because he was like his Father. His mercy and compassion went far beyond sinful man's level, and drew its model and its action from his Father's own nature. For us, decide who your Father is And then let your identity as His child define how you're going to treat people. Don't let people decide how you're going to react to them. The moment we start living on the level of simply reacting to what other people have done, we have surrendered the territory to what to people, what people do and how people think and live. Number three, if I'm going to go in the direction Jesus is going, if I'm going to follow Him, it will involve giving place to God's justice and then looking well to myself. Verses 37 through 42 appear at first to be unrelated, but they're bound together, both of them, by the obligation to be aware that even in a world where God's mercy is at work, His justice is still a reality. His generous justice, as someone has called it, is still a reality. And it requires me not to simply be inspecting your life or finding fault with your ways and so forth, but instead always to pay attention to myself first. Anything less than this would be moral superiority and arrogance that would be completely opposite of the Jesus Christ who took the form of a servant and dwelt among us so He could be touched with the feeling of our infirmities. Look at the two big images here are the measure, like a grain measure, and then the eye, the vision or the sight that a person has. He says to start with here in verse 37, judge not and you will not be judged, condemn not and you will not be condemned, forgive and you will not be forgiven, give and it will be given to you, good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over will be put into your lap. For with the measure you use, it'll be measured back to you. Someone observed that the connection between verse 36 and verse 37 is that we have a problem with God's mercy. Sometimes we think that He's not being fair by blessing people who haven't always deserved it and by not judging evil right away. And so we jump in and try to help Him with that. And this passage does not ignore God's justice. It says, with the measure you use, it'll be measured back to you. But it does remind us that God is the one who does the measuring back. That His fairness is the thing for us to respect, even in the way we're looking at other people, and to ask ourselves, wait a minute. Is my desire for justice just for other people, or is it for me too? And if I don't want it to be that way, then I've got to leave it to God to take care of the justice part of this, and not to be always condemning. If I'm recipient of His mercy in verse 36, then let me be forgiving. At the end of verse 37, this is something, of course, Jesus taught everywhere and He practiced Himself. And He wasn't practicing it when He said, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. He said it because they were doing something terrible and He knew what it deserved because He was paying the price for it. Then verse 39, He told them also a parable. Can a blind man lead a blind man? Will they not both fall into a pit? A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. Why do you seek the speck that's in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that's in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, Brother, let me take out the speck that's in your eye, when you yourself do not see the log that's in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to take out the speck that's in your brother's eye. The line of thought through all of this is important. Accepting the Lord's reality of who's blessed and who isn't, one undertakes to be motivated and be guided by loving action no matter what other people do. But then to realize that God's measure will be used according to the spirit of the one who regards it, and then therefore to try to deal with our own lives. Not to excuse ourselves, but to deal with our own lives. If we try to be the one who is superior, who is out front, who's setting the tone, who's making the judgment, when we've not ever even been fully trained ourselves, when we're not like the teacher yet, then it'll be a disaster. The illustration Jesus uses of hypocritical action in verses 41 and 42 is famous. It's humorous. It's also human. So human. The one who has a big log in his own eye trying to remove a little speck of salt. He couldn't even get close enough to see reality if it was that way because of the impediment to his vision. The person, however, who looks well to himself enough to deal with his own faults and to be real about himself is the one who is genuine. One of the most hypocritical things that can ever happen is for someone to quit the Lord and distance himself from the church and so forth because he thinks there are hypocrites there who then in his own personal life is busy doing things he thinks other people don't know about and don't see. There's nothing more foolish or more hypocritical to Jesus than that approach to things. Give place to God's justice and and look well to yourself and your own eyes. That's Jesus' way. That's what he says. Then number four, respect the integrity. Keep the integrity between what you are and say and do. Notice I didn't say in what you say, what you are and say and do. I'm not saying just have integrity. I'm saying respect the fact that there is integrity between what a person is and what he says and what he does. He uses an illustration, verse 43, for no good tree bears good fruit, bears bad fruit, nor again does a bad tree bear good fruit. For each tree is known by its own fruit. He's saying, the fruit of a tree is the announcement of what kind of tree it really is. For figs are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor are grapes picked from a bramble bush. Here's application now. The good person, out of the good treasure of his heart, produces good, and the evil person, out of his evil treasure, produces evil. For out of the abundance of the heart, his mouth speaks. There is integrity, it's unavoidable, between what's in the heart and what is said, and what is produced. There will be in my life, there will be in yours too, and Jesus says that's the way life really is. That kind of realization removes us from the process of trying to think about, all right, what can I do and not do? Who will know and who won't know? And then how much am I willing for that to cost me? No. Instead, just realize I am, you are what I say, what we say, and what we do. That's what the Lord is saying in this passage here. Maintain the integrity, respect the integrity between what you are, what you say, what you do. And then last, and I'm saying this last, not because it's the last word, but because it's the last paragraph here. Then following Jesus involves turning confession, Lord, Lord, into attention, hearing, and then practice, doing what the Lord says. His illustration is well known in verse 46. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not what I tell you? Everyone who comes to me and hears my words and does them, I'll show you what he's like. He's like a man building a house who dug deep and laid the foundation on the rock. And when a flood arose and the stream broke against that house and could not shake it, it could not shake it because it had been well built. That's what hearing the Lord and doing what he says is like. It's building well on a solid foundation, like we sung about. John read the words. He's the rock upon whom we stand. He's the solid rock. But it happens as we hear him and do what he says. Verse 49, but the one who hears and does not do them is like a man who built a house on the ground without a foundation. Not very smart, is it? When the stream broke against it, it immediately fell, and the ruin of that house was great. Now, if you really think about this, Jesus has taken us back to where he started. He's talking about what kind of a house will stand and what kind of one won't. What kind of a life is blessed and what kind of one is to be pitied. And it has to do with whether it's built on something that can hold it up over time, whether it will withstand the storms that come, whether it will still be there when things have revealed what was inadequate and what wasn't. And that comes from seeing things in his way, enough to love like he loves, and to pay attention to the real condition of ourselves, and to turn confession, I believe in him, into practice, I believe him. I really believe him. I believe him to the point that I'm trying to live my life in keeping with what he says. Not an invitation, but a proclamation of how things are. That's what Jesus offers us in this passage here. But we want to offer an invitation. Perhaps you see things his way. You want to be identified with him. You need to turn the Lord, Lord, into actual reality. If we can help you, either in obeying the gospel, in baptism, or something, as if you've gone off the trail and we need to pray about it and come back, if we can help you, let us know by coming while we stand and sing together.